I took a moment in that match where at 3 love down, like I just looked up into the sky and I just said, what on earth am I doing? What am I doing with my life? I'm injured. I'm playing for one ATP point and about $100. This match was worth about $100. And I'm dealing with this crowd who are booing me and making noise and wanting this kid to win. Like, why am I even out here? It was a real like moment where I questioned my purpose and I questioned whether this is what I want to actually do with my life.
Welcome to Living as You. I'm Patrick Quinn, a brain enthusiast, mental health advocate, and aspiring medical professional. And I'm here today to break down the stories behind the curtain, the moments of inspiration, the defining moments of our lives, and the shaping influences that have led inspiring leaders to live a life authentically to themselves. Our conversation this week is with former professional tennis player and current Inspiring Children Foundation staff member, James McGee. Growing up in Castleknock, Ireland, James always knew that he wanted to be a professional tennis player. From an early age, he trained, competed, and traveled the globe with this goal in mind. After 2 years of college tennis and studying psychology at NC State, James decided to turn professionally, where he remained on tour for 10 years. Having played at Wimbledon, the US Open, and all the Grand Slams, James stands as the highest-ranked Irish tennis player of all time. After a pro career in which he got up to 146 in the world rankings, but struggled emotionally, mentally, and physically, James decided to retire and completely turn his life around. In 2018, he came to the Inspiring Children Foundation and No Quit Tennis Academy in Las Vegas, Nevada, where he currently teaches tennis, helps with grant writing, and spearheads donor relations. I'm grateful to call him a close friend and someone who's taught me the art of being present. With that, I'd love to get to our conversation today with James McGee. James, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have the broski, the professor, the protein shake, the Irishman. You've got a lot of nicknames that we love using in the foundation. This has been so much fun. I remember the first time I met you about 4 months ago when I came to the foundation, and it was I think it was my second night in the boys' house in the green, 727, and I just remember sitting down with you, and I was like, this guy is one of the most present individuals I've ever met. And I remember you telling me one thing. You said, have you met Sophie? Have you met Cheryl? Have you met all these guys? You said, they're amazing people here in the foundation. And you were not wrong. I've been here 4 months. It's been an amazing experience. But I'm just so excited to sit down with you today. So thanks for being willing to have a conversation.
Thanks, Patrick, and thanks for having me. And I think in the last 4 months of knowing you, it's been cool because I've got to see you almost every day, and you've brought an awful lot already to the foundation in such a short period of time. And hearing your story and hearing the challenges that you've been through and the fact that you're doing this podcast and just all the things, and now you're preparing for the wellness experience and you're doing a bunch of different things. It's just been cool to get to know you, and I think that's something that I really value at the foundation, is meeting new people, hearing their story, and this is awesome. Really happy to be here.
So grateful. Well, James, you've done a lot of interviews. You've probably done a lot of podcasts. Is this your first podcast?
I've done a few. I did one earlier in the year. I've done a few when I was a professional tennis player for a number of years, but always happy to get on. And I know that you love to talk about authenticity, and you like to really go deep in a lot of these interviews, and so this is a different type of one because a lot of them are really based around sports, my previous ones, so it's nice to be able to talk about something different.
I can imagine. So I'd like to begin our conversation today by asking you to share about your upbringing, maybe your family, you're from Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I think when you share that with people or people know that about you, a lot of people in the U.S. at least, they light up. They say, wow, Rory McIlroy. I mean, I've always wanted to go to Ireland. I have a lot of Irish roots, being mm-hmm. Quinn. So tell me about that. Tell me about your upbringing and possibly how tennis even came into the picture.
Yeah. Well, firstly, when I meet an American, you know, I feel like 90% of them say to me, you know, I'm Irish. And I say, well, where'd you grow up in Ireland? They're like, no, like I'm 10% Irish. I'm 20% Irish, and they've never been to Ireland. So I find that quite funny based on my experience living here in America. But yeah, no, grew up in Ireland, lived in Ireland until I was 17. But I was very fortunate to have, you know, a very happy childhood. For the most part, it involved a lot of sports. It involved a lot of play. I lived, you know, roughly less than a mile away from my what we call primary school, which in America it's elementary school, and I would walk there every day. And I got involved in different sports growing up. We have a sport in Ireland called Gaelic football and hurling, which are two national sports. So I played the national sports growing up, and when I wasn't doing that, I was watching football or tennis on TV. And, you know, I have my sister who's 3 years older than me. I'm 34 now, she's 37. And my parents, my father was a detective inspector and a forensic photographer in Ireland. It's called the Garda Síochána, which is basically the police force in Ireland. And he had a career over 30 years in the Garda Síochána. And, you know, growing up, I asked him some questions here and there, but I don't know if it was top secret, but he wasn't really willing to share exactly the ins and outs of the job. Number one, I was just a young kid, you know, and number two, I'm sure it was private. And then my mom growing up, she worked in a computer marketing firm, and then she started coaching tennis. And my mom was very sporty, very athletic, still is. And she's the one that kind of got me into tennis at a young age. And, you know, I was into a bunch of things outside tennis as well. Like, I remember I used to write stories. I was not much of a reader, but I loved to write. I loved to, like, do art. I liked to dance. I liked anything that was kind of fun and physical. And thankfully, you know, because I know a lot of people, looking back on their childhood, it, you know, might have been a traumatic experience or a difficult experience. And I really empathize with that because I'm sure that's very difficult. But I was fortunate to have a fairly safe childhood growing up in a suburb called Castleknock in Dublin. And it was a kind of middle class kind of area. And then from there, when I went to secondary school, which is high school in America, that's when I started really taking my tennis to the next level. When I was 13 years of age, I met this guy named Larry Jurevich, who is a tennis coach from Canada. And at the time, I was getting more and more serious about my tennis, but this guy was someone who kind of came in and started talking to me about belief, the importance of self-belief, the importance of discipline, the importance of hard work, the importance of going the extra mile and doing the extra work when no one's looking. And he started giving me books to read about mindset and different athletes that had achieved great things and autobiographies. And that for me was a real, really exciting time because I finally had someone who not only believed in me, but gave me a pathway to achieving something in tennis. Because I, in my own mind, it was more of a pipe dream. It wasn't something that could actually happen. And when I met Larry, it started to kind of come together. We started to work with a squad of tennis players in Ireland where we used to train together every day. Sometimes, many times before school, we'd go to the gym afterwards. And between 13 years old and roughly 17, I really, really committed myself to my tennis. And you know, I could go on and on, but that's the guts of my childhood and early teenage years prior to going to college and prior to living a life as a professional tennis player.
So fascinating. So when you're younger, your dad's a detective, your mom's super big into, it sounded like, sports and a lot of activities. What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you want to be a detective like your dad? Did you want to be a pro tennis player once you started to find out, hey, I like this sport with a yellow fuzzy tennis ball and a racket? What were your thoughts? See, young James McGee, when you're just beginning to explore some of these activities and things in the world.
Yeah, I remember initially I wanted to be a fireman. when I was really young, and then I wanted to be a policeman, and then I wanted to be a writer because I started getting into writing a little bit more, and I started reading a lot of books by this author named Enid Blyton. That author wrote books about the Famous Five, and they were all adventure books, and they're about kids living on these different islands. And I've always had a sense of adventure. I've always had a sense of wanting to travel and see new places and discover new places. And with regards to what I wanted to do, by the time I was 11 or 12, I had my mind set on professional tennis. It was 11 or 12, which is very early for a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people don't know, you know, at 18, 20, I'm, you know, 34 now, but a lot of people at different times in their life, they just don't know what they want to do. And that's totally fine and understandable. But for me, I really felt called towards it because I loved the game so much. It wasn't just about winning. It was about just getting out there. I loved the challenge of it all. I loved how difficult it was. I loved every single aspect of the sport. So yeah, growing up, those are the main things that were kind of on my mind.
So you meet Larry, like you said, it sounds like when you were in your teens, and he starts to share with you these books, these words, a lot of this maybe wisdom from a mindfulness or a mental health standpoint. Do you remember, was there a particular value or mindful quality that stood out to you that you had maybe never heard about before or just really stuck? He said maybe it was hard work, maybe it was perseverance, maybe it was being self-love, maybe it was just commitment every single day to doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. What was one thing, because that sounds to me like it was a defining moment, you meeting him, and it sounded like it really shaped your path and made becoming a pro tennis player really possible in your mind. Tell
Absolutely.
Me more about that.
To answer your question, the one word or, you know, defining element of a lot of those books that I read and stuff, I would say the main one was discipline. I remember reading a book by this guy, Michael Johnson. And if anyone knows Michael Johnson, he had the world record for the 200 meters and the 400 meters before Usain Bolt broke it in athletics. And the thing, what was interesting about Michael Johnson, he wrote a book, I think it was called Slaying the Dragon. When I go back, like I'm honestly going back now 20 years, so I think that's the name of the book. And I remember him talking about, it took him over 10 years to shave off a second and a half from his time, from his running time. You know, because when he was a certain age, he ran it in 20.5 seconds or whatever it was, I'm making up the numbers. And then 10 and a half years later, he ran, you know, the 200 meters or whatever it was in under 20 seconds, in like 19 seconds. And he talked about how hard he had to work just to take off a second or a second and a half off his time. And that was just mind-blowing to me. I was like, how can this guy work that hard all for the sake of taking a second and a half off his time? But for me, that inspired me. And I was really into it, you know. I remember other books like Lance Armstrong's book prior to hearing about the doping and all that. He had a book called Every Second Counts. He had another book called It's Not About the Bike. And again, that was a lot about being tough. A lot of it was about dedication and never giving up and fighting and being a warrior in all aspects. But then the sad thing about that is he got caught for doping years later. But I guess at the time I was inspired by his story, the fact that at one stage he had testicular cancer and then he beat it and he came back to win the Tour de France. Like, that is inspiring. It was just very, very sad to hear what happened afterwards.
What did being a warrior look like for James McGee as you're beginning to train with that group of other Irish tennis players? You're beginning to probably play national tournaments. You're beginning to, this idea of professional tennis is beginning to really look like a reality. Mm. What did that day in, day out grind, determination, warrior, we'll call it Lance Armstrong, kind of all these guys' mindset or mentality look like for you?
Yeah, for me, I felt like I didn't really, I don't want to say become a warrior, or I didn't really own it until I was a professional tennis player. I mean, I was a great fighter as a junior, and I felt like you know, I was definitely always enthusiastic. I was always trying to win. I was always training hard. But when I became a pro, there was no other option. It was like, I have no choice here. Like, it's either I quit what I'm doing entirely, or I become a warrior and I fight like crazy and I make this happen. And so sometimes when your back's against the wall and you've no other option, that really brings out the best in you in a lot of ways. And so for me, again, coming back to the concept of discipline, there's a lot of early mornings doing your rehab and prehab routines. You know, there's obviously a lot of practice. There's time in the gym. There's time with the physios. There's times getting massages. And it's just a complete and utter commitment to your craft. And for me, I read a lot of books and I watched a lot of inspirational movies, and, you know, things like The Gladiator or The Last Samurai or anything of that nature that would spark that kind of warrior spirit in me. I was always drawn towards, and still to this day, like I enjoy it. I enjoy the concept of the hero, someone who overcomes the odds, someone who's the underdog and does something that no one else thinks they can do. That's pretty inspiring and it's fun. And I've always been drawn to that. So for me, I would look at different individuals in sports and I would take inspiration from them. But ultimately, you know, and I have a plaque right next to my bed right now here in Las Vegas. And the plaque says, be your own hero. So I don't think it's about looking at someone else and trying to emulate them, trying to be them. But ultimately, it's about being your own hero. It's ultimately about finding that kind of warrior within yourself or that hero within yourself and kind of trying to live that way. And I wouldn't say I've always lived it. You know, my life has been, it's gone up and down like a lot of people. Like, I've had challenges at times. During my career on the Pro Tour, like, I doubted myself a lot. I had injuries. I had setbacks. I had all types of challenges. So I guess it just exposes you and shows you who you really are when your back is up against the wall. So
the hero's journey, as you were sharing that, that's what was coming to mind for me. And I feel like each of us are on a journey of life filled with highs, lows, ups, downs, successes, moments of times where we're shaped by our experiences, the people we encounter, like Larry early on for you. So now, James, I'd love it if you could dive into some of those moments of your own hero's journey, especially as a pro tennis player. And from an outsider's perspective, a lot of individuals look at pro athletes and the life they're living, and you see it through the media, you see it through TV. There's a lot of glamour. Things are romanticized. It looks like everything is great, especially from a mental perspective, because we see so little. And I firmly believe, like, you look at anyone doing anything on this earth and you get a little snapshot into their life. But in reality, that snapshot tells you 0.0001% of what they're going through, what they're experiencing. And it's been one of my biggest missions on this earth, really from my first year in college when I was super lonely and going through a lot mentally, that I made it one of my life's goals to help other people who are going through, again, life's challenges. We all have our challenges, but how many of us think it's okay to share that with people? And being here in the foundation, it's obviously a very safe place where there's a lot of vulnerable conversation. People can open up and they feel that that sense of trust. But for you on the tour, paint me a picture of what real life was like.
There's countless moments over the course of 10 years, lots of highs, lots of lows. Well, just to give you a bit of context, I had done 2 years in college in North Carolina State studying psychology prior to turning pro. And in the summer of 2008, I got a phone call from a couple of sponsors in Ireland, and they said, listen, we see how you're doing in college in America. We, you know, believe you have a shot to kind of make it on the tour. Would you be willing to almost take the risk and go on the tour now? And, you know, for me at the time, it was something I really, really wanted to do. It was kind of like I don't want to say hitting the lottery, but it was a huge opportunity for me to kind of go ahead and pursue a lifelong dream. So when that was presented to me, I decided to take it and put the academics and the education to the side while I would pursue my career as a 21-year-old at the time. And I remember the very first tournament that I played. I had played pro events before in England and Ireland at different times, but my first event as a quote-unquote professional, I went down to Venezuela. And as many people know, you know, Venezuela is a very dangerous country. It was very dangerous in 2008. It's still, unfortunately, quite dangerous now and going through a lot of unrest. But at the time, the lower level professional tournaments tended to be in parts of South America, parts of the Middle East, parts of Africa. And to get on the ranking board, at the time, it was best to play some of these lower ranking events just to get the just to get into the tournaments so I could get on the computer system as a professional tennis player. And I remember going down there. I spent 3 weeks in a place, one place called Maracaibo, another place called Valencia. And from the very start, you know, my very first week on the tour, I got food poisoning. I was staying in a pretty dodgy hotel. I ordered chicken. The chicken wasn't cooked properly. I ended up getting food poisoning and I had a match the next day. You know, I had to bring the doctor in. I eventually had to go to hospital. I had to deal with all these situations. And to be honest, when I think back of like the low moments of my career, there's so many that it's hard to point one out. But that's just the start of the whole journey. So it's the first thing that comes to mind. You know, anytime you get an injury, that's a low moment. Anytime you take a tough loss, that's a tough moment. But there was one situation back in 2009 where I was playing Davis Cup for Ireland and we were playing against Cyprus. And I've shared this story once or twice before with some people, but I remember I was playing a doubles match against a guy named Marcus Bagdatis and this other guy, Fotis Kalias. And anyone who knows Marcus Bagdatis knows that he made the final of the Australian Open in 2006. He made the semi-finals of Wimbledon. He was a top 10 in the world player. And so this was a huge opportunity for me to just to be on the court with one of these top players. And the second point of the match, it could have been it was the second or third point of the match, I go up to serve, and as I land on my serve, after hitting my serve, I twist my ankle, and I immediately feel like a massive like crack or pull in my ankle. And I knew in that moment that I'd done some serious damage. Now keep in mind that I'm playing on live TV and there's thousands of people in this stadium that are watching this doubles match. And I didn't want to show people that I was like I had really, really hurt my ankle. So I ended up like looking over to the side at my coach and the team and I said, like, I need a physio now. And they were like, what? Like, why would you need a physio? Like, you've just played 2 points. Like, why would you need this? And I said, get the physio now. So I ended up finishing the game, walking over. We took a medical timeout. My trainer, Nikki Green, he looked at the ankle and he says, like, we're gonna have to tape this up. We're gonna have to take some Advil. We're gonna have to take some painkillers because you've seriously sprained this pretty bad. And so, long story is, I ended up playing through the match. You know, when you play a lot of these matches, you play off adrenaline and you play off the excitement of obviously playing for your country. There's no greater honor. So it was an amazing experience to be out there. But after the match, I had entered a tournament in Syria, in Damascus, Syria. Because it's not too far. It's a flight. You fly from Larnaca in Cyprus to Amman in Jordan, and from Jordan you fly into Syria. And I'd entered this tournament in Syria because back in 2009 I was really struggling with my ranking, and I decided to play some lower tournaments because I felt, you know, I need to play these tournaments to get my ranking up and get up there in the ranking. So I ended up flying out from Cyprus to Syria, and when I landed in Syria, it was 2 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday night, and my bags hadn't arrived, and I had a match the next morning at 10 a.m. because that's how the tournament works. Like, you know, you're usually typically first matches are on early morning on a Monday, and I went back to the hotel room. No one spoke English. There was no food in the hotel room. I was completely dehydrated. When I woke up the next day, you know, keep in mind I went to bed at like 3 in the morning. I woke up, probably had about 4 hours sleep, and I'm hobbling around because I've twisted my ankle from 2 days ago. Now, the right thing to do in hindsight would have been to pull out of the tournament. But because I was so desperate for points and because the tournament that I was playing was relatively weak, I naively thought I could just grind through it and just deal with this injury and get a few wins here or there. So picture this, I walked to the tournament site in Damascus and I've no tennis racket. And I've no shoes, and I'd literally walk up to another player, and I found this Australian player. His name's Sadiq Kadir, and I said to Sadiq, I said, and we'd never met each other before, but the Aussies are great, and I made a lot of friends with Aussie players over the years. I said, Sadiq, I said, I've no racket, or no shoes, no clothes. Can you give me stuff to wear because I got to get through this match? So he was kind enough to give me his gear, and I was due on to play this local wild card. So this Syrian wild card player who had probably waited all year to play this match because, you know, when you're a wild card into a tournament, you don't get in based on your ranking. You get in based on the local tournament putting you in or nominating you for a place. And so this guy that I played was a good local player, wouldn't have been a professional player, but he was ready to battle. And when I got to the court, we had people playing the drums on the side, you had people singing, you had all the local people coming out making tons of noise because, you know, again, this is the biggest match of this guy's life. And so I hobble onto court with pretty much a broken ankle, someone else's racket, someone else's clothes, someone else's shoes. And within the first couple of games, I lose the first three games, I go 3-love down. And it's about 40 degrees Celsius, so you're looking at like 110 Fahrenheit, it's pretty hot. And talking about low moments, I took a moment in that match where at 3-love down, like I just looked up into the sky and I just said, what on earth am I doing? What am I doing with my life? I'm injured, I'm playing for one ATP point and about $100. This match was worth about $100. And I'm dealing with this crowd who are booing me and making noise and wanting this kid to win. Like, why am I even out here? So it was a real like moment where I questioned my purpose and I questioned whether this is what I want to actually do with my life. And for whatever reason, I ended up grinding through the match and just fighting through it. And I just said, get through this match and we'll think about it afterwards. And I ended up coming through and winning the match in straight sets. But that was, even though I won the match, it was one of the low points in my career, early on in my career in 2009. But at the same time, it gave me a sense, okay, with all that's going on here, with all the difficulty that I have, I'm still willing to go through it. So that was one moment that stood out.
Unbelievable. To me, that says so much about you as a person, James, because even though the situation was pretty, we'll call it bleak in a sense. You don't have clothes, you don't have a racket, your ankle's broken, you're in a completely new country, you're playing, it feels like the whole world's against you. You were still able to push through, but yet you were able to kind of take away the underlying message of that, which was, is this my purpose in life, to be a pro tennis player, to be out here? And that's something we've talked about before that I'd love if you could go into more. As your career progressed, how did your view of professional tennis change with time, especially as you started to experience some of the highs, some of the lows, the loneliness mm-hmm. of being a pro tennis player? Can you talk about maybe some of the things that people don't always see with pro tennis and how that ultimately led you to living a life of such simplicity, joy, meaning, and mindfulness today with the foundation?
Yeah, I remember in 2017, which was the last year of my career, it was my 10th year on the tour, roughly, and I remember talking about loneliness. I remember just experiencing a lot of loneliness over the previous year or so. And loneliness, not having people to talk to after matches, going back to the hotel room alone, traveling alone, going from country to country. Keep in mind that you're pushing your body to the limit week in, week out. It's not like you're just not pushing yourself. You're going to the limit and you're playing these matches where, you know, you have match points and then you lose and you don't make any money. And you're losing money for the week. And a lot of people don't understand that might not follow professional tennis is you're not making a living in professional tennis unless you're well inside the top 100 in the world. In fact, there's even guys that are 100 in the world that are still, maybe they're making some money, but it's nothing to write home about, nothing massive. And anyone that's outside the top 100 or 120 in the world, they're making a loss. Which is hard to believe, like that you could be that good in a professional sport and still not making any money. And there's a lot to be said with that. And there have been a lot of conversations about how it needs to be restructured and changed. And I'm definitely all for it because it really does need to change. Throughout my last year, what was interesting is that on paper, anyone that was looking would have said I was doing great or I must be happy because I'm playing the Australian Open in Melbourne and then I'm going to Paris for the French Open and I'm playing in Wimbledon and I win a round in Wimbledon and then I'm getting to play at the US Open and the biggest events in the world in professional tennis. And on the outside that was the case, but on the inside I was just like, I was dying. I was like, I was just really, really struggling. And you could say it was a form of depression. There was definitely a form of depression there where I didn't know who to turn to. And as an athlete, one thing you're doing a lot of is you're protecting your ego and you're protecting your psyche a lot, because you almost don't want to admit it to yourself that you're struggling. You kind of just want to say, you know, bad, I'm just low at the moment. I'll get a win next week and then things are going to turn around. And there were moments in my life where I was struggling and then I would get a win and then things would be great for like the next month or so. I told myself that it was my unhappiness was based on my results. It was nothing else. And that wasn't the truth. The truth is my unhappiness was a variety of reasons. It was the way I was living my life. It was the fact that I wasn't expressing myself to other people. It was the fact that I wasn't taking enough rest to actually recover my body and feel good again. I wasn't doing the right things to take care of myself. And I had also felt I'd become really, really selfish. And by the way, as an athlete, you need to be selfish. You need to make decisions for yourself. But I felt like it was another level of selfish, and I didn't like that person who I was becoming. I didn't like myself. I remember winning a match in Wimbledon in July 2017. I had about 6 or 7 people watch. Well, I had like 20 people kind of watch that match. And after I won that match, I was like, okay, like, that was nice, but, you know, I'm at Wimbledon. I'm in the qualifying of Wimbledon. Surely, like, it's better than this. And then in the next round, I played a guy named Andrei Rublev. And for anyone that follows tennis, Andrei Rublev is, you know, I think he's top 10 in the world. He made the quarterfinals of the US Open that year. He's beaten Nadal. He's played, I think he has at least, but he's played the biggest tournaments in the world, and he's a top, top player. And after I lost that match, there were like 6 people watching that match, I ended up going back to the hotel room alone. I didn't have a coach. I didn't have anyone to have dinner with. And I was just walking the streets of London and just being like, is this it? Is this what I really want? You know, is this the lifestyle I want to lead? Do I want to be in these situations? And the answer was no. Like, I had done so much of it over the course of the 10 years. And I went on to play a couple of other tournaments throughout that summer. I played Toronto or Montreal Masters Series. I played some Challenger events. And as each week went on, week to week, it became more and more apparent that something wasn't right within myself. And the breaking point, of the, I guess you could say that the straw that broke the camel's back, was at a tournament in Lexington, Kentucky, where I won a match against this guy, Christopher Rungkat from Indonesia. And I won the match 7-6 in the third, saved, I think, multiple match points in that match. And typically when you save match points in a tennis match, you're pretty happy. You're like, you know, I did it. I fought hard. I got through it. Let's go. But for me, I walked up and I didn't have the energy to bring out a smile. And so I knew there was a problem there. So I lost the next match. And shortly thereafter, I ended up injuring my back in the lead up to the US Open 2017. And it's my belief that when you're not emotionally and mentally sound, things will show up in the body. And for me, that was my stomach at the time. That was also my back, injuring my back. And I was really emotionally struggling. And so I ended up getting injured in the US Open. And when I got injured in the US Open, I wasn't thinking, okay, it's time to move on and do something else with my life. I told myself I'd give myself a few months off to get rehab my back and come back. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it forced me to stop. It forced me to look at myself and just genuinely be honest about where I'm at in my life. Like, okay, this is good, this is bad, or, you know, where I was at emotionally, mentally, physically. And the fact of the matter is, I was a mess. I was a mess, not only on the tennis court, but I was a mess emotionally. I was a mess with my relationships. I was struggling financially at the time. I was obviously struggling because I hurt my back physically, and I ended up having a disc that was impinging on a nerve, a bulging disc that was impinging on a nerve, and all these other all these other big things that were happening. That was kind of the end of my pro career, and that's what kind of eventually led me to the foundation. I can talk about what led me in a second if you want, but that's kind of what the end of my pro career looked like.
Thanks for sharing. I think a lot of people, James, they would never expect that, because like you said, from the outside, everything looks great. When in reality, so much of what we experience in this world is internal. And you could see someone on the street, and they could bounce in a basketball, big smile on their face, and it looks like they have everything put together. But reality, their parents are getting divorced, they're wondering how they can feed their own children, they're going through a mental illness, could be going through anything. So I really, again, really appreciate you sharing that. And I'm interested, when that happened, when it felt like that was kind of the last moment, you had had enough of that lifestyle of going through those downs, of experiencing what maybe was envisioned when you were younger as this just incredible opportunity to play pro tennis. And I know you had many ups, but in reality, there was a lot of challenges associated with that life. Now, for people that don't know, you've been here with the Inspiring Children Foundation in Las Vegas, Nevada for 3 years. You live in a very, very small one-bedroom, kind of was a garage, casita. You live a very simple life. You've done a lot of work in the last 3 years to work on yourself internally through mindfulness, through self-love. You've done a lot of work with your own relationships. And as you've told me in the past, there is not really one thing in your life that you feel like you are not excelling at or doing your best at. You feel like you are living your best self, in a sense. And I think we are all on a path, James, of figuring out what our purpose is or what's next in life. And I know we've talked about that. We're both kind of discerning that right now. But for a lot of people that would know you, that seems like a pretty stark difference. You're living this time on tour, and now the last 3 years, you're with a foundation. You're doing a lot of internal work. Tell me about some of that work that you've done to reach a place of stillness and possibly some of those values that you really now prioritize on a day-to-day basis that maybe you'd never even thought about when you were a pro tennis player.
Yeah, I remember one of the things I said there earlier about, like, I didn't really like myself at the end of my career. I didn't like the lifestyle that I was living and the choices that I was making, from, you know, starting to go out more to living a lifestyle that wasn't, let's just say, it wasn't of my highest self, whether that's drinking, whether that's hooking up with people just for the sake of hooking up as opposed to really getting to know someone. Those type of choices, that's what I'm talking about. Firstly, after I got injured, I traveled around Southeast Asia for 2.5 months because I saw it as an opportunity to see the world, to kind of find myself in a way, because I was really lost, and to practice different things, whether it's mindfulness or meditation. And I remember when I got to Sri Lanka, I went, because my friend lives in Singapore, and when I flew out to Sri Lanka, I remember I started doing a little bit more yoga in Sri Lanka, and I found this cool teacher there, one of these perfect kind of picturesque moments where you're doing yoga at the top of this mountain in Sri Lanka with the sun going down, and he's asking you all these deep questions and you're breathing through it. And I remember, like, feeling in that moment like, oh, this is what I need to be doing. I need to be doing something where I'm looking after myself to some degree. And so when I got back to America and I was coaching tennis in early 2018, started doing more yoga, started hanging out with people in the yoga community. And when I was in a class in Atlanta, because I've been living in Atlanta for about 5 years, I had this great teacher named Graham. And Graham's been doing yoga for about 50 years, and he always makes you, he makes the classes that you do with him are very soulful. And depending on where you go for yoga, sometimes the focus can all be on the physical element, and there's obviously value to that, but I think ultimately it's the mental or spiritual. And so he was asking all these questions and the music was playing, and I remember asking myself the question, because I'd been struggling. Even when I came back from Southeast Asia, I was coaching, I still didn't know what I wanted to do in my life. I just said to myself, I said, who do I want to be? Like, if I make no money for the rest of my life, if I become nothing, if I have no power, if I have no girlfriend, if I have no family, what type of person would I be happy being? Regardless of what I physically have from a material standpoint or from an external standpoint, who do I really want to become? And immediately I thought of this guy, Ryan Wolfington, that runs the Inspiring Children Foundation. And now I'd heard about Ryan. This is a really long story, but I'll shorten it up. I'd heard about Ryan in 2006 because my roommate in college, Freddie Prendecki, told me about how Ryan had started this youth foundation, and with the purpose of helping at-risk youth turn their lives around through doing the right thing, through hard work, through different projects, through having a good attitude, through earning their own way. I had met Ryan for 5 minutes in 2015, and I had seen that this foundation that he had built had really grown. and hundreds of kids had gotten scholarships to the best universities in America, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, all the Ivies, all these amazing schools. And I also knew, because I'd followed him on Facebook, I'd also knew that he talked a lot about attitude and mindset and loving yourself and do like basically being a good person. And I was like, you know what? He's a cool person. I admire him. Why don't I just reach out to him and have a chat? And so I had no intention whatsoever of coming to Las Vegas. I had no intention of, in fact, Las Vegas was the last place on earth I wanted to live because I had been here previous times, and the last time I'd played a tournament, and when I flew off, I said, I am never returning to that city again. I mean, I hate it. That was my mindset. So for me to actually eventually come to Las Vegas to work for the foundation is, you can't plan these things. But when I did meet Ryan and I met the kids in the foundation, I was so inspired by the mission and the vision and the day-to-day and the focus and the core values and the culture that I was like, this is where I'm meant to be. This is what's right for me in my life. This is, I felt I was pulled here as opposed to I had to plan my way here. I felt like I was pulled here. So that was a lovely feeling. And so to answer your question with kind of my lifestyle and things like that, I just know that, one of the core values in the foundation that, we talk to a lot of our kids about, obviously the importance of hard work and having the right attitude, but we have this saying where we say, follow what you know is right. And so a lot of it comes down to trusting your own intuition, trusting your conscience on things in life. And when we talked about it and we went into depth, I realized that a lot of things, decisions I'd been making in my life, I knew I shouldn't have been making them, but I made them anyway. And so I made a decision. I said, okay. And oftentimes, like you often hear people say, like, I knew I shouldn't have been in that relationship, but I got it in anyway because I was lonely or I was this or I was that. And you hear countless times, like, I knew I shouldn't have gone there, but I did it. I knew I shouldn't have done this, but I did. And so I said to myself, I said, I'm going to start doing things that I know I should be doing. It's like the quote from Bono in the song One from Bono from U2. He's like, you've got one life, you've got to do what you should. And I started saying, like, I'm going to start doing the things I know I should be doing. And that kind of tied into, I knew I should be meditating every day because I knew my mind was powerful and I wasn't always in control. I knew I should be doing the yoga. I knew I should be eating healthy, which I've always ate healthy, but I wanted to take it to a new level. I knew I needed to work on myself and to stop any destructive behaviors. And so now, from being here, it was a real challenge for the first year or so. And Las Vegas, like people call it Sin City for a reason. There's parties, there's things to do, there's nonstop entertainment. But that wasn't or isn't for me. And so over the last, because I did that in my 20s, and you kind of get to a point, you're like, I'm done with this, It loses its appeal eventually. Yeah, for me now, I'm at the stage where I feel like I've been following all the things I know I should be doing. I get this great opportunity every day to work with kids on the tennis court. I also do private lessons. And then when I'm not doing that, I'm in the foundation office. As you see, Patrick, we're preparing for events. We've got amazing leadership speakers coming in. We've got countless projects. We've got festivals coming up, like the one we're doing with Jewel called the Wellness Experience. And I just feel really in line with what we're doing. The fact that I live in the boys' house and I drive one of the foundation vehicles and I'm 34 years old and I'm living this life, it doesn't, I'm not bothered by it. Like, I mean, there's countless, the vast majority of my friends have a girlfriend or they're married or they've got kids. And it just hasn't happened for me at this stage in my life. We'll see what happens in my life. We'll see what the next stage is. But for now, it's continuing to focus on doing the right thing in my life and making myself better. I mean, let me be clear, like this hasn't been easy. Like there's been a lot of lonely moments still. Like this is not like, oh, you just decide to follow what you know is right and life's all good. Like, no, it doesn't work like that. Life gets tougher when you try to make the right decision. You get tested all the time. But I like a challenge and I'm happy where I'm at right now.
And how would you compare the level of purpose, fulfillment, you could call it happiness, joy, that you feel living this more mindful lifestyle through yoga, meditation, eating right, doing what you know is right, maybe compared to when you were on the tour? And there were a lot of ups and downs, and we'll call them yo-yo life moments. How do you compare the two?
The tour is very much like a yo-yo. It's like a roller coaster, at least from my experience it was. The highs were super, super high, and the lows were super, super low. And here in Las Vegas over the last 3 years, I haven't felt any super, super low moments. I've felt plenty of high moments, but I wouldn't have felt anything to the in terms of adrenaline of competing in Davis Cup or playing in a Grand Slam. Those moments can't be replicated because that doesn't happen in day-to-day moments. Now, it's cool watching someone else, whether it's a young junior tennis player playing a tournament and they have this amazing moment where it clicks and they win a match or they win a tournament or they get something. And that's exciting for me. But it's a different feeling. Like, it's just different. And for me, I prefer where I'm at right now. I mean, I did think at one stage, you know, after a year of being out, like, of professional tennis, I thought, you know, maybe I could return. There's plenty of players that are playing well into their 30s. But ultimately, it has to be right within your heart, within your soul, and that's the only thing I'm going to listen to. Like, nothing else will get it in front of that. I will say that my relationships are very meaningful and very deep here. And on the tour, I had good relationships, but I wouldn't have said they were very deep. There are some people like Roger, this guy Roger Kirschenbaum, who I was close with in Atlanta, who's a very good friend of mine. That's a deep and meaningful relationship. He's supported me a lot, and I go back to Atlanta and see him here and there. But the feeling of connection and community is second to none here. You know, and that's something I really, really appreciate. Because kind of, I guess, dealing with loneliness on the tour, that's something that I felt I didn't really have as much. Now, it was cool to go home to Ireland and see my family and see my friends, and I did feel that connection. But for a lot of time, I was alone. I don't miss it. I felt like I did my best. I don't look back with regrets. I did as best as I could. I think every athlete, when they look back on their career, they probably say they could have done something better. They could have won this tournament or that tournament. Everyone has a match that they should have won that they lost. And probably vice versa, they should have lost that they won. But I'm very happy with where I'm at here. And
if there was one thing you would want someone to take away from your story, from your experiences, maybe as a professional tennis player, but the joy, fulfillment, the type of lifestyle that you live now, what would it be?
There's a lot of things, but I'd say one of the first things is learn to meditate. And that's something that I didn't do when I was a professional player. I tried it, but I didn't really know how to do it, and I got impatient with it, and it just seemed like it wasn't working. I don't want to sit in my thoughts all day. Like, that's what my mindset was. I don't want to deal with this. This is painful. But as I practiced it, and we have a very simple meditation where, you know, you find a comfortable position, and it doesn't need to be 20 minutes to 30 minutes. It can be 5 minutes. It can be 1 minute if you want. You close your eyes, and every in-breath is one, every out-breath is two, every in-breath is three, every out-breath is four. And you might count up to 10 and then work your way back down to zero at your own pace. What's interesting about that experience is when you're doing the meditation, I've noticed when I first did it is I couldn't count to 10, one to 10, and then down to zero without getting lost in thoughts, without thinking about something, without noticing the thoughts coming up in my mind. And I was like, this is a real issue. Why can I not count to 10 with my eyes closed without thinking about something? And I learned that it's just my mind. You know, people call it the monkey mind or whatever, the crazy mind to some degree. And I would have these crazy thoughts, like the thoughts that didn't make sense, whether it was about the future or the past or something I'm insecure about or whatever. And I learned that through meditation, you learn that you're not your thoughts. You're not the thoughts that are running through your mind. You're the observer of the thoughts. You can choose to focus on your breath and what's in front of you in that given moment and not feed into the thoughts. Because the more you feed into the thoughts, the more energy you give to that thought. And it grows and it grows and grows until it's a lot bigger than it actually is. It starts off as a seed and then it grows into a massive monster if needs be, if it's a negative thought. And even the same with positive thoughts. I don't think you need to obsess on them. I think you need to notice them and then let them go. That's been a huge practice. I mean, I haven't missed a day of meditation, definitely in the last 3 years of being in the foundation. And then in my previous year in 2018, I started on a much more frequent basis. So I would share that with absolutely anyone who's going through some trouble to take the time to learn how to meditate and to learn to let go of your thoughts. And secondly, I'm gonna add that it's so, so important to express where you're at with someone. There's a lot of people that we're afraid to share what's going on in our lives, or we're afraid of being judged, or we're afraid to, yeah, just to express ourselves. And when I started to open up and be vulnerable and basically air out the thoughts that were going through my mind, I realized, firstly, it wasn't as big a deal as I made it out to be. Secondly, other people are going through the exact same thing. And thirdly, there's a way through it, and there's a way to deal with it. And a lot of it comes back to coming back to the moment, to what you're doing, and then doing the right thing, following what you know is right. So if you let go of your negative thoughts, and if you start doing the right thing in your life and following what you should be doing, you're going to feel better. Guaranteed, you're going to feel better. That's not to say challenges will arise. That's not to say, like, you know, life's going to be perfect. You're still going to have to deal with difficult moments, difficult people, difficult experiences. But if you can learn to let it go consistently, day in, day out, I think you become a stronger person. And by the way, I'm dealing with it every day. Like, I sometimes, like, I meditate, and I'm like, have I really been doing this for this many years? Like, I feel like a beginner. You've got to bring humility to it as well. Like, anyone that says they're an expert and, like, I'm the best meditator, like, run a million miles. They don't know what they're talking about.
Run a million miles. I love that. No, that's great, James. You said it all so brilliantly. Okay, now I'd like to do what I call five question flash with each of my guests. So I got five questions for you, James.
Okay.
We're just trying to get to know you a little bit better as a person. So tell me whatever first or second thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
You ready for this?
Getting nervous.
If you were to have dinner with any person on this earth, who would that person be and where would you go?
Oh, come on. And where would I go? So, like, what type of food would I eat?
Yes.
The first person that comes to mind is Mike Tyson. Because Mike Tyson, for me, is such an intriguing individual. I read his book, The Undisputed Truth, a number of years ago. And I find it so interesting. Here's someone who made it to the pinnacle of his sport, considered the baddest man on the planet, the most dominant athlete, probably in any sport at one stage. I mean, he would knock people out in 2 seconds. Like, he was just ferocious. But to see how he's changed his life, to see how all that means nothing to him, and he's like a family man now, and he's become very soft, and he's very open, and he's very, very insightful. And people might not know that about him. They might think if he's a thug or he's this or he's that. But if you actually listen to what he has to say, he's extremely insightful and very sensitive. And I know from talking to friends in Las Vegas who know him, they've also shared the same thing. And I'd love to meet someone like Mike. I'd love to meet him. I'd love to talk to him and get to know him and hear more about his experiences. I would go to, people that know me in Vegas know that I love this restaurant up the road called Flower Child, and it's got the best, it's just got the best food ever. I'm vegetarian for the last 3 years, and they've just got great, great food. I'd probably bring them to Flower Child.
Yes, Mike Tyson, James McGee at Flower Child.
Let's do it.
Let's
hope you're listening, Mike.
The Broton Particle himself. Question number two. You're in a car, and you've got like a 2 to 3 hour drive. What are you doing? Are you meditating? Are you listening to music? Are you listening to a book on tape? Are you trying to learn a new language? How would you spend your time?
I think phone calls. I think getting, you know, I love to have these type of conversations. I love to hear where people are at. I love to connect with my family, my close friends, and just see where people are at. So it also depends on the time, like with Vegas being 8 hours behind Irish time. And so if I wasn't doing that, I tend to listen to podcasts. So I've been listening to Tim Ferriss for the last, I don't know, since he started his podcast, like whatever, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe longer. So I listen to a lot of him, and I love his questions. I love how he gets deep with people. He's very clear and gets to the heart of a lot of matters. And I love that because I love getting to the core and to the heart of a lot of matters. And then audiobooks here and there. I don't listen to them as much as I probably should. So, yeah. And then if I'm not doing that, it's music. So
you love your music.
I love my electronic music. I've been also listening to J. Cole lately. I like his new album. Yeah, anything that's inspiring, anything that's going to inspire me to be better or help me articulate things better to other people or help someone else. Like, just as long as it's not negative. I struggle to do things that are negative, like even negative music. You know, I don't want to listen to negative music. You just know when you listen to it whether it's right or not. I don't want to listen to that stuff. I want to listen to something that's gonna pump me up to do good, you know?
So that leads right into question three. Give me a song that you're currently listening to or maybe listened to in the past month that has fired you up and you think other people should listen to because of the hope, the optimism, the positive message that it conveys. What's a song that comes to mind?
The first one that comes to mind, so we were fortunate to have one of the Las Vegas Raiders come to our foundation office in the last few months. His name is Darren Waller. Darren Waller is the tight end for the Raiders. He's got an incredible story about overcoming addiction, about going through tremendous adversity. He got arrested 3 times and he was in his early years, he was doing a lot of dumb things in his life and he was struggling. And he struggled with his mental health and he struggled with self-love. And what was interesting about Darren when he came to our office is he shared his journey through recovery and to becoming one of the best tight end players in the league, in the NFL. And he's an amazing, amazing individual. He shares great stories. He's open, he's vulnerable. And he's now, you know, he's obviously free from any drugs and alcohol and he's really working on being his best self. But what's also interesting is he likes to rap. And he just released this song on Spotify less than a week ago called Stop Me. And he also has a song, I think it's called Comeback or Comeback Stories. He's got a podcast called Comeback Stories, but he's got a song called, I think it's Comeback. And I've listened to his song lately, Stop Me, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Like, you know, people aren't hearing it on the radio because, you know, he's only released 2 songs, but the lyrics that are in the song, and he talks about gratitude, seeing the lotus in the mud. Like there's, you know, these type of things, talking about the importance of pain and going through struggle and doing the right thing in his life and wanting to flourish and being an example to others. Like that is just, wow, I want to listen to that. So in the latest few months, that's been one song that I've, or latest week, I should say, that's been one song that I've listened to. And that like gets me going.
It's epic. I can't wait to listen to the recent one, but I heard the first one, and it's hands down. It's awesome. It'll fire you up any day.
100%.
Number 4, you're Irish. A lot of people love that. The Irishman, James McGee. What is one aspect of your life today that was influenced by the 17 years you lived in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, lived there for 17 years, and then over the last 17 years, you know, I haven't lived there as much. I've gone back and spent a few weeks there at a time, sometimes a few months. And in Ireland, it rains a lot. But the beauty about the rain is the country is so green. Like, it's the greenest you'll ever see. You know, it's green beyond green. I am a massive nature lover. I mean, I live right next to the Phoenix Park, which is like, I think the first or second largest park in Europe. And I've grew up in around trees and I grew up around greenery. And I remember going down to Monaghan to see my cousins, which is further north in Ireland. We'd go down to see my cousins. And I remember countless summers where we would like play in the grass. And I think based on my childhood, based on growing up in Ireland, I just have a massive appreciation for nature. I have a massive appreciation for the earth. You know, I really do love it. I feel a connection with it deeply. I deeply, deeply love the earth. I love nature. Anyone that's ever spent time with me, I've no doubt there's a healing element to the earth, to feeling the wind, to touching the earth, to jumping in water. All these type of things are really, really, really important to me.
as one of our good friends would say, Miller, 100%. 100%, you're spot on with everything with the earth and the nature, James. 100%. And last but not least, number five. And this, you talked about Tim Ferriss earlier. This is a Tim Ferriss special. If you knew that there were going to be millions of individuals that were going to look at a single billboard that you could put one message on, what would that message be, James? A word, a phrase, a sentence. You get the space of a billboard that millions of people would see every day.
The first thing that comes to mind is you are not your thoughts. I think that would like jolt people. I think when you can jolt someone, that's when you can kind of get through to them. That might stun a few people, because I know from my conversations with people, when I say that, they're like, what? Like, how am I not my thoughts? Like, I'm thinking in my mind the whole time. It's like, yeah, you're thinking, but that doesn't mean that's who you are. Like, who's the observer of your thoughts? And I think if people can become less in their head and more in the moment, more present, I think we're going to have a better world. You know, because people are going to make better decisions. They're going to be able to let go of their anger, let go of their hatred, let go of their sadness. Because that's all, a lot of it is just thoughts that are being built up in our head, and we listen to over and over again. We're just playing the tape. And I think if people are out of their head and in the moment, I think there's a better chance that good things are going to happen.
You're not your thoughts. That would be an awesome billboard. That's phenomenal. James, thank you. Thank you for the conversation. This has been, I've wanted to do this ever since I met you. That was the first conversation I said, dang, other people need to hear James' story.
Thank you, Patrick, and thanks for, that's the fist bump. People can't see that, but appreciate you, of course, for what you do, for running this podcast, for going out of your way to do this, for trying to help so many people. And as I said at the very start, like you've done so much already in such a short period of time. And I think everyone here at the Foundation appreciates that. And I do remember the sunflower that we gave you during the Malibu retreat. For those that don't know, we had a retreat in Malibu a couple of weeks ago where we bring our Foundation kids down there. It's a great place to unwind, to relax, to reflect, to kind of figure out what they want to do next in their lives. And Patrick was, without a shadow of a doubt, doing the most work, helping the most, just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So, you know, that's just a small example of what you did in that 1 week, and you've been doing that week in, week out. So it's been cool getting to know you, Patrick, and I appreciate you asking me on the podcast, and maybe you can do another one sometime in the future.
This week, our unsung hero is addiction expert and Hungarian-Canadian physician, Dr. Gábor Maté. Over the past several decades, Dr. Maté has revolutionized the medical profession with his research on addiction, trauma, and stress illness. Thank you, Dr. Maté, for your unbelievable compassion and willingness to speak out against false narratives when it comes to trauma. Your recent documentary, The Wisdom of Trauma, is life-changing and something everybody needs to see. If you want to check it out, go to thewisdomoftrauma.com. And until we meet again, don't forget to keep living as you.